sitting in my living room in San Diego County. And the first thing I want to say is there have been a lot of women who have stayed through the decades who have been a part of this. And it may piss you off for me to say this, but thus far it's been quite the testosterone fest. And when I was new, there were women here. There were women who supported us. And many of the people who have taught me things through the decades have been both men and women. And Jimmy and I had a talk about this, about I have some names to give him. And I think that part of the situation with women not being equally represented is that we end up being caretakers. And I know that I've spent the last 10 years of my life caring for my ill husband and for my autistic bipolar son. And a lot of times, you know, our service is done in other arenas. You know, we are of service not only in the service structure of Narcotics Anonymous. I know I sponsor, I think at last count it was 14 women, some of which I've been sponsoring for 25 years. But I also am heavily involved in service to my family. And that has a tendency to take us away from some of the service structure arenas that other people, you know, have been a part of. Not that I haven't been a part of the service structure arena, and I think that I was listening to Jack share, and I don't know if he remembers this, but in 1975, I think I had a year and a half clean, and I had attended a service meeting down under a bridge down in the middle of Los Angeles, and we had, I don't even think we had two set regions at that point. We had what we knew of, or what I knew of then, is that we had Southern California and we had Northern California. And we had no areas. Greg and Jimmy had put together the NA tree. And I remember having conversations with both of them about, you know, this service structure that needed to be, you know, put in place so that we could have interaction between the groups and representation between the groups. And so we had this meeting one night, and there was a fist fight between Danny T and somebody else from the Hollywood area, I believe. And at the end of that meeting, we had two areas. We had the Hollywood LA area on one side of the hill, and we had the San Fernando Valley area on the other side of the hill. And Jack Bernstein and I sat down one night. I was living in a flea bag motel on Sherman Way in North Hollywood. My husband was using at the time. And Jack and I sat down one night and hammered out the very first area guidelines. And I have to chuckle, you know, when I go to meetings now and people are talking about, we're going to redo the guidelines. Kathy, do you want to come redo the guidelines? I have probably redone 15 different area guidelines since I got clean. And that needs to happen. People need to be involved. People who have a sense of history and why things, you know, have kind of shaken out the way they have through the years need to be involved. I have no problem with that. I am not as active in local service, you know, as I used to be, because I have my hands full right now. That, and, you know, I hate to cop to it, but, you know, as you get older, come 8 o'clock at night, I want to snuggle in somewhere. You know, I don't want to be drinking coffee till 11 o'clock at night, you know, in a service situation. So, but I do try to share what's been given to me through the years. Someone mentioned Greg Pierce, and in 1974, when I first got clean, I was married to someone who didn't want to be clean. And I remember I drug him Greg had a meeting in Studio City at his house on Tuesday nights, and you had to call him and get the address to get there. And so I, act of bravery at this point in my clean time, I called Greg and I said, hey, are you having a meeting? He said, yeah, come on over. And I went to Greg's house. I drugged my loaded husband along with me. And that was the first time I saw the NA tree. He brought it out and we had a long conversation about the NA tree. And then I remember talking to Jimmy about this NA tree, how important it was going to be because we were starting to grow and we needed, you know, some kind of structure. And Jimmy and I sat and talked, and he talked about how this structure was different than the previous structures from the other fellowship, because he knew that, you know, that we needed to be fully involved on a personal basis, that our service structure was not going to be one that took place by an elite crew behind closed doors somewhere that you heard about briefly occasionally, that we needed people to come together and to learn how to negotiate and how to apply the traditions and how to come up with a consensus of the group for things that needed to be done, and that addicts were not good at negotiating, that, you know, contrary to, you know, the previous fellowship where a lot of the members there, you know, had lives before they fell apart, you know, had, you know, education, had families, had job situations. Most of us that were coming in, you know, following, you know, peace, love, rock and roll, a lot of drugs in the 60s. You know, I got here in 1973 and stayed clean in 1974. A lot of us, you know, weren't has-beens. We were never were's. We didn't know how to do these things. We didn't know how to get together as a group and hammer out problems and do things. And that our service structure needed to be one where addicts were included and supported, you know, through with learning how to negotiate and learning how to talk to other people and learning how to, you know, express feelings without, you know, downshifting into fuck you, you know, which we're also good at, you know. And it was a whole new ball game for me when I left his house that night, because I realized how important what we were doing was, you know. I don't know why I was so blessed to be born at a time in history where I was made available to, you know, the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous in the San Fernando Valley. I will be forever grateful to my loving God to me that saw to it that the message was carried to me. And I was very resistant at first. I didn't want to commit to not getting loaded, because I could not visualize my life not loaded. You know, I did not use because it made me feel good. I used because it made me not feel. I just wanted to get as close to death as I possibly could. That was my life. I was 24 years old and I just wanted to be checked out all the time. And now, all these decades later, I can't imagine what my life would have been like if I hadn't have found Narcotics Anonymous, you know? And I remember service meetings at Jimmy's, a very humble setting, nobody was showing off nothing. We were there to work. We were there to be, some of us were good students. Some of us weren't. And I was just, you know, thrilled that somebody actually wanted me to show up and had something for me to do when I got there. You know, something that was positive, something that not only fed other people, but fed me. And I think that, you know, when we're new and people, you know, are kind to us, I couldn't understand why people were being kind to me. You know, they didn't want anything from me. I couldn't, you know, I'd come off the streets and I'd come off, you know, a 4-year run on heroin and everything else and be ahead of that. And I was so sick and so debilitated, and I had nothing to offer in my estimation. And yet my need offered people being of service an opportunity to invest in not only me, but in their own process of recovery, you know. And I'm going to tell you a story about a 12-step call I went on. One night I was alone, and they tell you never to go alone, but of course I didn't listen to that. I was different. So I was about a year and a half clean, and there was a woman named Susan, who I think is passed. She came and went for a long time. She was living in a motel in North Hollywood, and I had run into her at a meeting, and we had decided, you know, that I would come and get her that night and take her to a meeting. And I went to this motel, and it was one of those motels that her room was upstairs, and I remember walking down this long, dark hallway, and the smoke was just hanging in the hallways. You couldn't see from one end of the hallway to the other. And I found her room number, and I knocked on the door, and there was some shuffling go around inside, and all of a sudden the door cracked open, and here was Susan standing there with her sleeve rolled up. I remember her sleeve was rolled up, and there was blood dripping down her arm, and she began to tell me, well, I can't go to a meeting tonight because so-and-so came to see me, and, you know, maybe another night. And I had brought a book with me, and it wasn't our book, it was another book, but I handed her the book, and I told her, you know, if you're interested, you know, give me a call. And I was so angry. I was irate. And I remember I went downstairs, and I went to a phone booth, and it was pouring rain. And I remember that because the rain was pouring down through the ceiling of this phone booth. And I called my sponsor, and I said, doesn't she understand? I'm trying to help her save her life. You know, what is wrong with this woman? I was yelling at my sponsor. And then it got real quiet. And my sponsor said, Kathy? I said, yeah. She said, are you still clean? And I said, yeah. And she said, you need to get your ass to a meeting. And so I went to that meeting without Susan that night. But I got a real strong message about being of service, that it wasn't always going to turn out the way I wanted it to. But the important part was that I showed up and I carried the message. I planted the seed, and that I was investing in my own spiritual bounty at that point, whether I knew it or not, that I was willing to put my ass on the line to try to help somebody else. And I don't think people understand that being of service for us is not something, you know, we do on a whim or because our sponsor thinks it's right, or, you know, we want to go hang out with, you know, our friends or whatever. That this is like spiritual oxygen to us, that it's like the breath of life. Service is like the breath of life. And we do it not to be wonderful people or to be remembered for starting this meeting or writing this or showing. We do it because our lives fucking depend upon it. That's why I do it. I know that my life depends upon it, you know? And I am one of those hardheads who have been put myself in some terrible positions in my clean time, made some incredibly interesting decisions through my process that put me in peril, and was able to, you know, pull myself out by working steps. And I would not recommend that to anybody else, to any other women I sponsor. If I think you're getting close to the edge of the cliff, I will run out in front of you and say, danger, danger. You know, you're standing on the precipice. You know, anytime we think that we can get somebody else clean, or that our happiness depends on somebody else being clean, we are in terrible danger. And I felt the need to do that a couple of times in my life, and I don't feel the need to do that anymore. And the importance of surrounding myself with people who believe in this thing and who continue to show up has always been so important to me. You know, I'm not one of those people who has ever said, oh, gee, I'm tired of meetings. I think I'll take a couple of months off. I have never, once I went for 2 weeks without going to a meeting. And that's because I was a single mother with two little boys working in a new job position in the middle of a move. And that's the longest I ever went without going to a meeting. And as soon as I was able to, I went back to a meeting. And I run into so many new women. Well, through the years, I've run into to so many women who, you know, say, well, I can't get to meetings because I don't have a sitter. I can't get to meetings because, you know, Bobby's homework or whatever's happening. And I try to share with them that, you know, when I was new, I was working in recovery when I was about 2 years clean, and I had a baby, and I had just left a using husband, and I lived on $6 a month, which even in 1976, 75, 76 was not a lot of money. And I had these little envelopes that I kept. This was my budgeting process. I had an envelope for rent, and I had an envelope for food, and I had an envelope for childcare, and I had an envelope for utilities. And every time I got a paycheck, the first envelope that got filled was childcare. And luckily I had a woman who lived downstairs from me who was just dying to, you know, watch that baby when I went to meetings. And sometimes I didn't have the money, but I would tell her, you know what, on payday, I will pay you. And she always got paid. And I made it a priority. I knew that that little boy needed me to be in recovery. I knew that it wasn't just about showing up and being seen. It was about taking care of me spiritually, about going and being with, you know, people in the fellowships. And I know that all of you are just fine with these damn Zoom meetings. They're painful for me. You know, they're like right now, it's like I am a talking head on a screen, and I'm watching a couple other people over here just so I can pretend I'm talking to them. But the Zoom meetings have, you know, really forced me one more time to push myself past my comfort zone and learn how to work all this technology. Thank God I live with a daughter-in-law who, you know, shows me how to get on here and how to turn up the volume and how to do this and do that. And I ask questions. I humble myself and go out and say, you know what, Ashley, could you help me with this? And I would much rather, you know, just snuggle under the covers and, you know, hit Netflix for a couple hours. But I make sure that, you know what, I get to three or four of these meetings every week. And just to see some faces, you know, just to know that you're there. As I'm talking, my phone is blowing up because I have people, you know, sending me little messages. So could you guys like stop till I'm done? It would be good. So somebody mentioned Jack Whaley. And Jack Whaley, as it's already been discussed, was so aggressive and so out front about, you know, quit whining and, you know, suit up and show up and do what you got to do. And I remember when I first sat in meetings with him, I would sit in the back of the room because I was terrified of this man. Most of us were, the guys were terrified of him. And he would, you know, indict the group. And then, you know, I had a relapse. Well, I kind of relapsed continually the first 6 months I was around. I couldn't quite get it in my head about complete abstinence. So after I took the first step, which is a whole another concept, I personally believe you take the first step once. Once you get it right, something clicks in your gut, and using is a moot point. It no longer happens. Now, it may take you 20 years to take the first step right, but once it happens, you know, using is like the farthest thing away from me. You know, it's like a dark, you know, horror film or something, you know. So But that's just my concept of the first step. But anyway, I came back from this relapse and I went to a meeting. I know it was down in Hollywood somewhere. And Jack Whaley was there, and I sat in the front row. I sat in the front row of this meeting and I looked up at him and he was yelling at people. And I wasn't afraid. And I was no longer afraid because I knew he wasn't talking to me. I knew for the very first time in my life that I wasn't going to use no matter what. And once that settles into your gut and into your heart, and you know that the only thing you have in front of you is learning how to live an abstinent life, you're never the same, because you can't play those head games. You know, you can't downshift into, you know, oh, but I'm an addict. You know, to me, people who refuse to stay clean, you know, don't give themselves the opportunity to grow up and enjoy the freedoms that NA has to offer us. You know, I live a life of freedom today, you know, and a life of humility. Every time I take a cake now, it is such an act of humility, because the longer you're here, the more you understand how fragile this thing can be and how grateful you are for still being able to, you know, breathe and sit in a meeting and watch the miracles happen. And it is an act of humility to keep showing up. And I know that every once in a while I run into one of those people who says, well, I'm tired of the meetings. You know, I'm not hearing anything new. Everybody's saying the same things over and over again. And my message to you, if you're out there, is that, you know what? If you're not hearing what you need to hear in a meeting, you're the one who's supposed to be saying it. You're not supposed to put this back on everybody else. You are the one who's supposed to be carrying the message. So if you want to hear something positive in a meeting, or you want to hear somebody, you know, elaborate on their, you know, experience and working the steps, you're the one who's supposed to be saying it. So all that other fucking hogwash about, you know, that, you know, we're supposed to entertain you in a meeting. Meetings aren't always entertaining. Meetings are where we go to save our lives. And I have sat in some incredible fucking meetings, but every meeting I've sat in is incredible because I was there. Because, you know, there are still people in the world who never get a chance to recover, you know. And I worked in treatment the first 25 years I was clean. I left after that and did some other things that, you know, I'm proud of and that, you know, I really enjoyed. But the first 25 years I worked in treatment, and it was an incredible opportunity for me to watch the miracles happen. You know, it was also an incredible opportunity for me, you know what, to grow up and to make some different decisions for myself. And I will never regret having spent that time working in treatment. And I will never regret leaving that world and going out into the private sector and doing some different things, because I've never left Narcotics Anonymous. And when Jack talks about, you know, if you work in treatment, you know, it's got nothing to do with, you know, carrying the message. Not only does it have nothing to do with carrying the message, if you work on the front lines day in and day out with the raw illness, you don't need NA involvement less, you need it more. Because it is hammering away at you, whether or not you're aware of it. You need to be more involved. You need to safeguard yourself. You need to surround yourself with, you know, the message, you know, of recovery. And sometimes that's very difficult to do in treatment settings, you know. So I would just, anybody who's newly clean and considering, you know, doing that for their livelihood, you really need to know that you have to take care of yourself first. You have to do this. And what else did I want to talk about? I think I want to talk about commitment. You know, I want to talk about how important it is, you know, to learn how to commit to something, commit to, you know, this way of life, to remember that, you know, when we talk about honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, I don't think that it was, you know, just a fluke that the word honesty comes first in that line of three spiritual principles. I think that, you know, to learn how to realize that life is short, tell the truth. You have to tell the truth here. You have to tell the truth according to your heart. I'm not talking about God's truth. I don't know God's truth. I know the truth according to Kathy's heart. And I know how important that is. And I know that, you know, if I hadn't learned to do that, and it was very difficult for me to learn how to do that, because I came off the streets where if you told the truth, you were in big trouble. You know, people, you couldn't tell the truth. You know, your whole life was a lie. I was a chameleon when I got here, and I'm not a chameleon anymore. People who know me know me. They don't know who I think you want me to be. They know me. And so to learn how to be honest and follow that up with open-mindedness and willingness separates the herd, you know, because it's not enough just to throw out your honesty. You know, you have to be open-minded enough to get some good feedback, and then you have to be willing to try some new things in your life, you know. And my life today is, you know, being of service to my family and being of service to the fellowship. And I honor that every day of my life. I wake up and I'm grateful every day. I live in on a hilltop in San Diego County. It is so gorgeous here that even with, you know, the quarantine going on, I have the opportunity to be outside and close to the earth, you know. And some of us, you know, well, all of us, you know, if you work the steps, you have a belief in a higher power. My concept of a higher power has changed so drastically through the decades that, you know, I have a God now that probably doesn't look like your God, but it's my God. And funny story about that is that Jack Whaley used to tell everybody he was an atheist. He was a devout atheist, to the point where when we would close the meeting and circle up, he would refuse to pray. You know, he would either back out or just, you know, make himself, you know, he'd just kind of disappear, you know, when we'd all be praying. And then, you know, Jack and I worked together in a treatment setting, you know, for a few years. And one year, and I remember it was Christmas time, we found this tape, and it was long after Jack died. We found this tape of Jack Whaley sharing, and we were standing in an office, and he was sharing. And when it came to the end of his pitch, he said, "God bless us, everyone." And Jack and I looked at each other and said, "Did you hear that?" So even at the end of his life, he was, I won't say he was a believer or that he had, you know, changed drastically, but those words came out of his mouth and they were sincere words. And I'll never remember, I'll never forget, you know, how incredulous a moment that was, you know, that after all these years of everybody talking about, oh yeah, he was an atheist, you too can be an atheist, you know, which is fine with me, I have no problem with that. But in the end, that's not what we heard. So wherever he is now, I would like to think that, you know, he's found, you know, whatever it is he can considers his power greater than himself. I'm sure that Narcotics Anonymous was. Be quiet here for a second, because I feel myself when I start getting too wound up, and I don't want to be like the crazy old lady wound up the talking head who's wound up. So my husband has been very ill for the last 5 years, and that has called for some drastic changes in our lives. And I am sustained through my continued service of this fellowship. And I don't think it's possible when you're 25 years old, newly clean, or 35 years old and 10 years clean, or any of those decades, you know, that I've gone through, many of us have gone through, where, you know, you get so caught up in the newness of different situations in your life, you know, getting your first, buying your first home, having your first child, going through your first divorce, falling in love again, moving across the country, changing job situations, going back to school, getting a little card with, you know, your name and a bunch of, you know, letters behind it. And so now you can feel like you're really a person now. All those things, you know, kind of run together through the decades in your clean time. And then you reach the point where I'm at, and you realize that all those things were wonderful, but they weren't the most important thing, you know. And Chuck talked about this, that, you know, that Jimmy was not a wealthy man, you know, monetarily, but he was wealthy in, you know, what he had helped create, you know, and had the people around him. And that's how I feel in my life now. You know, we moved from Arizona to back to California, you know, about 6 months ago. And Rick and I had this big house in Arizona. We had a wing with three bedrooms and a bath in it that wasn't being used. You know, I was away from my children, who were both in California, and I was surrounded by all this stuff. You know, we have all the, you know, bling bling, you know, we got stuff, you know, we're not rolling in it, but we had nice stuff. And I woke up one day and Rick was very ill, and I was there alone with him, and I realized that my wealth was not in this house that we had. My wealth is in my children and my grandchildren and being of service, which I can do anywhere, and with the people that I love in my life. And it became very clear to me that it was time for a change. And I got rid of so much stuff that I had put years into acquiring, you know, stuff that, you know, you just drag along with you, you know, and pay to put in storage and drag along some more, you know. I just felt the need to just get rid of this stuff, you know. So now we've combined two households. I live with my younger son, who's 37, and his wife, and my two grandchildren, and Rick and I live here, and I'm not alone. And I think that I feel so grateful for that, because I am surrounded with, you know, laughing children and sidewalk chalk art and jiu-jitsu classes and someone to talk to in the morning, have a cup of coffee with. My daughter and I have gotten very close. My son is helping me put together my garden. We have like an acre of land, and you know, there's one part of it that's going to be just my garden. And that's all I want. I don't want a lot of stuff. I don't want a lot of notoriety. I don't want any of the things that used to be so important to me. As I get older, the only thing that is really important me at this point is that when I leave this fucking place, and I mean this world, that I feel equitable and centered with my loving God, and that I know that I've done the best job I can since I've been here. The best job as a mother, the best job as a sponsor, the best job as a wife, the best job as a member of Narcotics Anonymous. I'd like to think I'm a role model to other women because I keep showing up no matter what, you know, and that's all that's important to me. All that other happy horse shit that I worked so hard for all those years is not important to me. And I don't feel like I'm, you know, dying. I'm not going to leave this. I'm telling my kids to come in. They've got groceries. They just came from the grocery store. Hey. I don't feel like I'm leaving. I'm probably going to be here another 10 or 15 years. And I'm going to spend that 10 or 15 years trying to be peaceful, trying to be centered, trying to be grateful for everything that I have, and loving the people that are around me and that I've been surrounded with. So with that, you know, Jimmy just flashed me the 5 minutes, you know. There are many other women who have stayed here. There are some who have fallen off, just like there are a lot of men who have fallen off. But there are women in Narcotics Anonymous carrying this message, hell or high fucking water, whether or not our faces are melting off of us at this point. We are here. We love you. And, you know, I will keep coming back. So with that, Jimmy Jam, I love you. You are my third son. And send me a picture of the puppy. I love you. That's it. Bye, guys.
All right, man, you guys better have your phones off because I'm telling you, he's not going to take this.